KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, for many years there was, at least in academic worlds, no Asian American art history. Most of the artists of Asian American backgrounds were erased or neglected. That's according to Berkeley's Douglas Smith, or interned and segregated from mainstream American culture. Now, a new exhibit and a new volume of Asian American artists brings the work of many of these important as well as obscure artists back into the public spotlight. We discuss the exhibit presently at San Francisco's D. Young Museum and the accompanying art book that chronicles the largely up until now forgotten 19th and 20th century art of Asian Americans. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. It's our second hour, and in this hour, well, a first-of-its-kind exhibition of mostly up-until-now-forgotten Asian American artists is presently at the San Francisco de Young Museum through the 18th of January. Asian American Modern Art, Shifting Currents, 1900 to 1970, is billed as the first comprehensive survey of 20th century Asian American art, features over 200 artists. And Stanford University Press has published an accompanying volume titled Asian American Art, A History, 1850 to 1970, featuring artists of Asian descent living in the United States, the majority of whom were Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, but nevertheless who cover the continent. Many of these artists were professional artists who lived by their art, but who were for the most part neglected or marginalized. And in this forum hour, we're going to talk about Asian American art. Joining us here in studio is Gordon Chang. He's professor of history and director of the Asian American Studies Program at Stanford. He's also senior editor of Asian American Art, A History, 1850 to 1970, and co-directs with Mark Dean Johnson, the Stanford Asian American Art Project. And welcome, Gordon Chang.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. Also great to have Mark Johnson, who's professor of art at San Francisco State, principal editor of Asian American Art, A History, 1850 to 1970. He co-directs, again with Gordon Chang, the Stanford Asian American Art Project. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me begin, if I may, Gordon Chang, with you. You're the historian, and the history is very important here because we're talking about artists who were really marginalized and who prompted both of you to enlist students and do research and kind of an archaeological dig almost in some ways to find out who these artists were and what their work was.
Well, you're right. It wasn't a dig. Many of these artists had been forgotten, but they had been forgotten mainly by contemporary audiences and art observers. And one thing you mentioned in the beginning comments, that they were marginalized. Well, yes, they were, but at the time, many of them were not. In fact, they were quite celebrated and respected and had spectacular careers. So these are not necessarily stories of like Picasso, I mean of Van Gogh, who didn't get very far when he was alive. Many of these artists went quite far.
I said some famous, some obscure.
Yeah. Some were obscure, but at the time, a number of them were quite famous and celebrated or collected by museums, by art collectors, and had fabulous careers. And then were kind of neglected and marginalized subsequently. So that's more raises a question about art, how art history is written.
Well, in Asian American studies classes and so forth, there wasn't really much, if any, evidence of Asian American artists being part of those curricula.
You're right. We can talk about the marginalization of these artists by mainstream art historians, but they were also marginalized by Asian American studies specialists who were more interested in other things and didn't know quite how to think about art, didn't know how to think about these intellectuals, many of them we can call intellectuals. Asian Americanists were more interested in labor or community or something of that sort. But when it came to looking at some of this artwork, it was pretty hard to decipher.
When we talk about Asian American art, we're talking about a kind of hybridized art. There's a lot of Western as well as influences that go back to the Asian continent. Nevertheless, it's such a broad continent and there's so many different cultures. To bring it under one rubric, how does this work in terms of your perspective?
Well, it is a big rubric, and you're right that there is a hybridity there. If you look at the art, you can detect influences from Western European art, and you see East Asian influences. But in other artists and the other artwork, you don't see necessarily any Western influence or Eastern influence in a very pronounced way. Let me give you one example. There's an artist I really like. His name is Eitaro Ishigaki. He came to the United States from Japan in the early 20th century to join his father, who was a laborer up in Washington State. Ishigaki loved art. He was a teenager. He took up art, and then he was completely trained in Western idiom. And you look at his art, and no one would ever have a clue that he was from the East. He became a famous proletarian artist in the 1930s, and he painted paintings of workers, of protesters. And to look at his art, you never guess that he was from Japan. But we have none of his art. As much of it is as a important document for American history, he was one of the founders of the John Reed Club in New York City. But it was hounded out of the United States during the 1950s. His artwork, all kind of shipped to Japan. You can only see Ishigaki's paintings about American history, about American social life in Japan.
Gordon Chang is professor of history and director of the Asian American Studies Program at Stanford and senior editor of Asian American Art, a history book put out by Stanford University Press. Your father, of course, is one of these artists, and your father did, a work that was seen to be... In fact, we were talking about people called Orientals right up until 1968, right? Asian American kind of eclipsed that and took its place. But your father's work is a good example of this kind of hybridized work, isn't it?
I think so. He's kind of the reverse of Ishigaki. My father was born in China, became interested in art there, in traditional Chinese brush painting, but then went to art school in Shanghai during the 1920s and was taught in complete Western idiom. So his early work is very figurative. It's drawings of with charcoal and pencil of faces and figures and oil color and all this. And then he decides he's going to return or recover Chinese brush painting. So that's what he does. He trains himself to use the Chinese brush, and he becomes quite a well-known Chinese artist. But there's the impact of the Western training on him is quite clear, including in the painting that's in the show. Of this Messengers of
Peace. This is the one that was given to FDR, in fact, his third inaugural, presented to him.
That's right. The Chinese government commissioned him to do this, and he did this in wartime Chongqing as the bombs were falling on the air raid shelter, and he paints this immense painting of Messengers of World Peace to be sent to the United States through diplomatic channels at the time.
Also, Mark Johnson here with us, who's professor of art over at San Francisco State. And we're talking about how some of these artists were famous, Don Kingman, the sculptor Noguchi, the Korean video artist,
Nim-Joon Paik.
Nim-Joon Paik, yeah. I mean, some of these people were really well known, as Professor Chang suggested, in their time. But there was a lot of necessity not only to rediscover them, but also to discover those who were not known. And students enlisted in this. So talk about that whole odyssey, I mean, how that took place.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful odyssey, and roughly 100 students have been doing research for this project over the last 15 years. And what that meant was, in some cases, we would go, for instance, to the Deyoung Museum and look at the archives from the 1920s or the 1930s. And we'd come across a name that looked like it might be someone that we could be interested in. But that's all we had. We had a name. And so from there, we brought it to students and we said, okay, let's figure out who this artist was and see if we can track down what happened to them. So we'd look at obituaries, we'd look at death dates, we'd try to find next of kin. In some cases, the students actually went to the cemeteries to try to find out death dates to start this whole process. And eventually for the more obscure people, we've happily seen family reunions of people that, generations that have been dispersed over several states. One of the best recoveries, I think, was a woman named Mary Tape, who presented a solo exhibition of her work in 1885, possibly the first woman of Asian ancestry to present a solo exhibition in the United States. And we phoned someone that had the right name in Portland, Oregon, and they said, yeah, I'm looking at one of her paintings in my living room right now. Ultimately, we were able to recover quite a bit of her work. Her work is represented in the Stanford University Press book, but not the exhibition, because, again, she's a 19th century artist, and the exhibition at the Deyoung Museum now focuses on artists active between 1900 and 1970.
But in both the book and the museum, you see this extraordinary range, don't you?
Yeah, there's an incredible range. There's a great variety of styles that are represented. We see styles that come, as we've been discussing, from Asia. There's a word Nihonga, which means Japanese painting style, like Nihonmachi. there's works that some people would look at them and say, they can really see the evidence of the East. But actually, in many cases, there's a wonderful calligraphy by an artist named Martin Wong. And he tells the story of a sewer goddess who pulls a boy into the sewer where he drowns. And it's written in a very elaborate calligraphy style on a very long, thin piece of paper to suggest Chinese calligraphy, but that's about where it stops. So there's a very self-conscious referencing of Asia in sometimes humorous ways to perhaps point to someone's interest in recognizing their own cultural heritage, but in a completely innovative way.
Well, in some cases, you see a pretty dominant Western influence. I was struck by Yun Ji, a work called Where's My Mother, which really is Cubist. I mean, you know, you can see the Cubist influence pretty dramatically. And then there's another work called Mountain Fantasy, which looks like it's right out of Gauguin. I mean, the Western influence is very prominent here in so many cases.
Yeah, well, Where Is My Mother, I think, is interesting because it points to other issues, and it points to some political issues because Yun Ji is a paper son. You know, he was able to come to the United States because of the destruction during the 1906 earthquake of immigration records, which made it possible for him to claim that his dad was born in the United States. But his mother could never come because of the laws that restricted immigration at that time. So it is a Cubist painting that has an interesting sociological background.
But you get the story, too, which is really, you know.
Yeah. And
so important.
One thing I want to mention about that painting, it was made in the mid-1920s at the same time that Mr. Chiura Obata was making his fantastic Nihonga-style paintings. One of the things we did was look at art reviews from the period. Many of them are written in Asian languages. There was a critic named Matsusaburo Hibi who wrote a review of Mr. Yun Ji's work, like Where Is My Mother? And he said, he told young students, I encourage you to take your training from Mr. Obata, who's really rooted in the great Japanese Nihonga style. Mr. G looks like he's just squished a parrot dead with those on the canvas with those brilliant colors. You also mentioned Chichen S. Chung Lee's painting, The Mountain Fantasy, which does have that symbolist Gauguin style. But it also evidences the living chi of the earth, because embedded in the cliff face are nude figures that are moving in the mountain. So it is as if the earth is alive. The chi is embodied in a Western idiom. So it's very...
These are literally hybridized paintings.
Yeah, very international paintings.
And Mark Johnson's professor of art at San Francisco State and one of the principal editors of Asian American Art, A History, 1850 to 1970. And co-director with Gordon Cheng of the Stanford Asian American Art Project. We want to bring some other folks into this discussion. One of them is Irene Poon, who is a visual resource curator in the art department at San Francisco State and who has her own work featured in the De Young exhibit and in the book as well. And Irene Poon, good to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, your photo is one in the photo that you have in this exhibit, one that goes back to 1965, Memories of the Universal Cafe. And this was essentially a Chinatown cafe before Chinatown kind of, turned more touristy, I guess one could say.
That's right. It was when Chinatown was a really tight community. And I grew up in Chinatown. My father had an herbal shop there, and, and as children, we spent all our time at the herbal shop on Grant Avenue helping my father in his business. So the Universal Cafe was a photograph that I took when I went there with a couple of friends from college, and we had, I think it was dinner, and then I saw this picture, and I happened to have my camera with me at the time, and so I captured it, and I was, very lucky.
Well, you also probably feel lucky that this exhibit and book have resurrected so much spotlight again on Asian American art.
Yes.
I mean, it was, from your perspective, kind of extraordinary that this exhibit and book took place, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It truly was, a real learning experience for myself, having been a little bit, a part of it in some ways. And it's like an archaeological find. And for me, you know, when I was growing up, people like Don Kingman and Jade Snow Wong were, you know, the artists in Chinatown. And, of course, Jade Snow Wong had her pottery shop in a window, not too far from my father's herbal shop, as a matter of fact. And then, of course, Don Kingman was like, you know, the magic name that we all knew, the famous artist.
Jade Snow Wong also published a lot of poetry. And of course, you know, you've got a lot of these local artists who are still celebrated, like Ruth Asawa.
Yes.
And, you know. But you you studied some photography at San Francisco State and
yes.
Still print your photos on silver paper, do you?
Oh, yes, I do. I'm a true dinosaur. I refuse to go digital until the day comes when I can't get the chemicals anymore or the paper or the film, for that matter. But I do everything myself.
Well, I appreciate so much you being with us, and congratulations on Memories of the Universal Cafe, having been part of both the exhibit and the book. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
It's Irene Poon, who is Visual Resource Curator in the Art Department at San Francisco State. Kimmy Hill is also joining us by phone this morning. She's a granddaughter of painter Chiura Obata, who is featured in the exhibition as well. Good morning, Kimmy Hill.
Good morning.
And let's talk a little bit about your grandfather, who taught at Berkeley, which was very unusual for somebody of Japanese-American background to be a teacher during that era. And then was relocated into the Topaz internment camp for a whole year, as I understand it.
Yes. So he, of course, with all the 120,000 Japanese-Americans on the West Coast were forcibly interned during World War II. And so he was already a professor at UC Berkeley at the time. He had been teaching since 1932, and he was on the faculty. So it was unusual as a member of the community, a Japanese community, an artist and a professor who was also involved with the white community as much as he was with the Japanese community.
He was, in fact, able to go back and teach at Berkeley after the internment.
Yes, he was, yeah. Yes.
But he came initially to Europe, and then he found life here to his liking and stayed here and became really, his métier was painting California landscapes.
Yes, well, when he actually was planning to go to Europe to study Western art and to see the world. He was a young man. He was 18 years old, but he got to San Francisco first in 1903 and really fell in love with painting the California landscape, and that is one of the first paintings you see when you see the current De Young show is his landscape of the Yosemite and the High Sierras. It was his inspiration in his art and his life is to paint from nature and to learn from nature.
And if you get the book, which all this art, so much of this art we're talking about is included in, you see on the cover of it, Setting Sun in Sacramento Valley, which is a silver brocade scroll done by your grandfather back in 1925.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, this show is a fabulous opportunity to see that piece. It is usually housed in the Midwest. And so I encourage, you know, your audience to see the show, not just, you know, of course, for his work, but just the richness and the variety of the artwork that is there.
Mm-hmm. And Kimmy Hill, we appreciate very much your being with us, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Kimmy Hill is granddaughter of painter Chiura Obata, who is featured in this exhibition. And Gordon Chang, she mentioned the internment of her grandfather for a year. There's also a painting in this exhibition called Winter Internment from the same camp, Topaz, the same mm-hmm. internment camp.
Mm-hmm. The paintings from the internment period are important for a variety of reasons, one of which, related to our project, is that it was the inspiration for looking further. Researchers began to look at this magnificent artwork that came out of the internment camps and began to study it. And this was the first kind of first look into what we call Asian American art. And then we began to think, well, were there other artists? And then we went from there. So the internment art was quite an inspiration for this investigation.
And here is this painting, Setting Sun, beautiful painting, which does have, again, both Eastern and Western qualities to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rich, luxurious-looking painting right on the cover of your book. Down in your basement for about 40 years, is that right?
Not my basement.
I mean, down in the family basement for about 40 years?
Well, it hasn't been really appreciated as it should have been for many of these years.
And that holds true for so much of this work, Mark Johnson. What do you want the public to know about appreciating this work and really getting a sense of what it brings in the way of value aesthetically?
I think we joke, those of us that have been working on this project for a lot of times, we joke and say it isn't very often that we get to be a part of rewriting American cultural history. And I think that's what this project does. It causes us to rethink the contributions of this important population. When we first started thinking about this, one of the scholars in our group said, well, of course, we know Asians are really good with computers, but what about art? I haven't really heard much about that other than Kingman, Kuniyoshi, and Noguchi. So now we have files on literally more than 1,000 artists active in California alone, so the national scene represents, you know, many thousand people. So there were many thousand professional artists doing interesting work that wasn't historicized, and we think, well, why wasn't it historicized? A conversation we were having a few minutes ago, and I think this hybrid quality of some of the work is an important thing, and it's hybrid in two ways. It's hybrid both iconographically. Sometimes we don't know the stories that it's based on. We don't know about the chi of the earth. We don't know about the butterfly dream of Chuang Tzu. These are not familiar to some of us who grew up in the West.
The cosmologies, in fact, too. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. But it's also unfamiliar stylistically sometimes. So we look at these things and say, well, that doesn't really look American. But of course, that causes us to rethink, well, what does American art really look like? Then there's this lingering sense that maybe these people really weren't Americans. And then when we think back about our immigration history and remember that if one was born in Asia, you couldn't become a naturalized citizen if you were Chinese until 1943, if you were Japanese, 1952. So the mid-20th century. So because the exhibition looks at this early period and these people couldn't become American citizens during that time, I think that, again, causes us to rethink our American cultural history, to think about the issues that really impacted these artists' lives. And finally, because so much of this work comes from the West Coast, art capitals of Honolulu, Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, as well as New York, sort of shifts the balance because American art history is largely told from a New York perspective. But if you tell it from the New York perspective, this great diversity isn't included in your story. So that's some of the things we hope people will
could
think
change
about.
The whole nature of many of the curricula, again, on campuses in terms of not only Asian American studies, but history and art history and contemporary art history.
Well, we certainly hope so. I think one of the challenges is what Mark just talked about, is how to interpret this art, because it was, and this is one of the reasons why perhaps it wasn't historicized and appreciated by historians in the past. We gathered teams of researchers. Mark mentioned students, but we had graduate students. But we also had professional art historians, East Asianists, Americanists, photography specialists, social historians to make sense of this art.
This is quite a contribution, and congratulations to both of you. And I'm going to open the phone lines. I know there are many of you out there who are interested in responding to what you've heard so far and asking questions about this contribution that Asian American artists have made, which has been, as we've said, marginalized for certainly recent decades. If you have something you'd like to say and contribute to this conversation, any question or comment, feel free to join us now. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available to you. Again, 866-733-6786, or send us an email. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A first-of-its-kind exhibition is presently at San Francisco State's The Young Museum, and it will be there through the 18th of January. An accompanying book, Stanford University Press put out, chronicling the largely forgotten 19th and 20th century art of Asian Americans. So this is all about Asian American art. We're talking with a couple of scholars who have really been behind this whole project and who are the co-editors of the book. And we spoke earlier also with Kimmy Hill, granddaughter of painter Chihiro Obata, who's featured in the exhibition, and Irene Poon, who is a photographer whose work is in the exhibition. Gordon Chang here with us in studio is professor of history and director of the Asian American Studies program at Stanford, and Mark Johnson's professor of art at San Francisco State, and they are the co-editors of Asian American Art, A History, 1850 to 1970. And I should mention that Gordon Chang also and Mark Johnson direct the Stanford Asian American Art Project. Let's go to your calls, and Marianne, we'll begin with you. Good morning.
Hi, this is Mariana. And when I was growing up in Berkeley, my mother took some Fumier painting classes from Mr. Obata, and I have two of his paintings in my home. He used to do demonstration paintings, I think, when he was showing techniques to the classes. And I have a rooster about to peck up some little seeds with a couple of bamboo branches overhead, and a flower that I think looks like a morning glory with sort of tendrils and leaves growing up around it. And it's really special to have that art.
It sounds wonderful. Well, what about people who discover some of these paintings in their basement again? Where can they go? Or if they want to make a contribution tax-free or anything along those lines? Part of your project, isn't it, inviting that?
Well, we hope museums will be receptive. They have a new look, have a new feel about this art and these artists. And, and reverse the trend, which was that some years ago, when this art went into eclipse, museums were getting rid of this stuff. They were selling it off. They couldn't appreciate it. And I think that's turned around. So we need more commentaries like from your listener here.
And Marianne, thank you for that. It reminds me, we had Bram Dijkstra on. I don't know if you know Bram Dijkstra, cultural historian, and has written many books on American art. He rediscovered a lot of the art of the 30s, which was literally thrown out, because it was political and people were concerned about Bolshevism coming across in the art. So a lot of it was destroyed. And some of this art, again, resurrected and really has made a major impact again on the consciousness of art dealers and art museums and universities.
Can I say, so just jump in here, about Marianne says something about a painting that she has that has a morning glory. It looks like a morning glory. Well, I haven't seen it, but the morning glory is an important kind of symbol in Japanese traditional art and also among Japanese Americans. Morning glories grew well in many of the internment camps. And I don't know when her painting was painted, but many of, if you look at photographs and you talk to internees, and many of them decorated and tried to prettify their surroundings by growing morning glories. And I have a book out also a few years ago by Stanford Press, which is called Morning Glory, Evening Shadow, which is about a Stanford University professor who had to go to internment and he grew morning glories.
And we're going to bring more callers in. Yen Lu joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Yen Lu. This question is for both Gordon and Mark. I really appreciate your comment about double marginalization, first by the mainstream and then secondly by Asian American studies itself. I'm curious whether Gordon and Mark, whether you're going to do any research on other arts, not just visual art. I'm a choreographer, and I did the first work about Chinese in America called Golden Mountain, and it would be very interesting to include other aspects of Asian American arts.
All I can say is, I couldn't agree with you more. My own training is in art, so I'm the visual art guy, and certainly many people have asked why we didn't, for instance, include more contemporary artists, because this survey stops in 1970. And I think the answer to that is there's so much more work still to be done, and certainly the other art forms are most deserving of this same kind of historicizing. And I think the same issues of marginalization impact other art forms.
I think we're just at the beginning of recovering this creative history of Asian Americans. We couldn't take up some aspects of art, such as flower arrangement or garden design, architecture, carving, and some of these dimensions, which I hope others will take up. But you're right. There's so many more dimensions to be investigated. I'm helping some colleagues at Stanford look for a professor in music history. And I've been astounded to see the number of people, young scholars out there interested in Asian American music. jazz and earlier. So I think we're just at the beginning of a change of our attitude.
Yeah, Lou, thank you for your call. And let me go to more of our callers. We go next to Eric. And Eric, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be on the show. I had a question for Gordon about the California Impressionist movement, which is very popular here, obviously, for, you know, I mean, it's huge now. Everybody's really into it. But I was curious if you came across a lot of Asian American artists from the California Impressionist period of art.
I'll let Mark take this one. This is a good question.
Yeah. So certainly there are several astonishingly fantastic, I'll say, Impressionist painters in the research that we've done. But the work in the exhibition is not really focusing on that group. I'm going to mention a couple of names.
Well, actually, I think a caller. Weren't you going to mention Bertha Stringer Lee?
Eric, is that an Asian artist?
Is she an Asian American artist? We don't know, apparently. But anyway.
I was going to mention Tokio Ueyama, and Gordon was talking about how the internment research about the art that was produced during the camp helped us become more aware of artists who were established before the internment, like Mr. Obata. In Los Angeles, there was an artist named Tokio Ueyama who was a fantastic landscape painter coming out of that California Impressionist style. And, you know, most of the time, in fact, you know, when we contacted the family when we first, you know, started our research and we asked about the internment work, and they reminded us that, you know, that was such a short period in such a long career. And for many of these artists who did experience the internment, and of course, we don't want to only look at that work, even though it is so historically valuable. It's so interesting to see what they did both before and after that experience. We do see that after the internment, a lot of these artists, the art world had changed so much. Abstract expressionism became so prominent that the artists who were working in a more representational landscape style sort of fell out of favor. But in the case of Mr. Ueyama, for instance, there's great work from the 20s and 30s that I think you'll find very interesting.
Eric, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. And there's an artist named Tyrus Wong in this exhibit who I believe is responsible for Bambi. Is that correct?
Sure. He sure is. And I'll tell you, it was such a thrill at the opening of the show that Tyrus Wong himself showed up. And it turned out it was his 98th birthday. So this is someone who came to the United States at the age of 8, alone, was spent several weeks in Angel Island before he was reunited with his father in Sacramento, which is itself, I think, an astonishing tale. And then he was a natural talent, and people recognized it early. And I've seen paintings from the 20s that are very accomplished. And by the 1930s, this was a major figure. He exhibited with groups. One of the groups is called the Oriental Artist Group of Southern California. It's a word they used at that time to create opportunities for themselves, painted with the WPA. And then in the late 30s, because of his prominence, he was tapped by Walt Disney to come in and do the background set design for Bambi. And so if you look at Bambi again and you appreciate this Asian American influence in the film, again, I think it causes us to rethink our American cultural history.
What distinguishes the motifs of this kind of hybridized art that we're talking about? I mean, can you quantify it? Can you break it down for us?
I would say absolutely not. Anything but.
I mean, the continent is too big, for one thing.
Yeah. But, and I think Gordon was talking about an artist who was extremely Western. There's no trace of an interest in expressing his heritage. But one thing I did want to mention is there's a great painting by Alfonso Osorio, Filipino-American, in the exhibition. And when you look at it, it's an abstract painting. You don't experience any sense of East Asian culture. Of course, he's Filipino. But when you read about what he drew his inspiration from, and he talks about going to the Peabody Museum and being inspired by ethnographic art, by Pacific Islander traditions, trying to create a new visual expression that explores the horovacui of that, the ethnographic materials, you can see that there's a conceptual link that ties him to other artists who are interested in expressing their cultural heritage in some visual way.
At the same time, I think that you can detect this hybrid style, and many of these artists deliberately sought inspiration from artistic trends and traditions from the East. So Tyrus Wong can draw Bambi, but he also draws and paints in calligraphic, clearly Chinese calligraphic style. Dong Kingman paints in a way that would not give anyone a clue that he was of Chinese ancestry in many of his paintings. But in other paintings, he's quite deliberate in adding Chinese calligraphy, Chinese calligraphic stroke, perspective and composition. And that's true with many of the artists. Because of their marginality in American life, they were in some ways more receptive to cultural influences from other places, especially from East Asia, but also Latin America, from native traditions. They were not stuck in an American canon as maybe other artists.
But some of them, if you put their work up and said to somebody, this is done by an American artist or an Asian American artist, you couldn't tell the difference, really. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, in African American literature, there are writers like Ann Petrie and Frank Yerby who wrote novels that were essentially all about American life. Ann Petrie wrote about Italians up in Massachusetts. She happened to be a black woman, but she was working toward, in her art, I suspect, some kind of assimilation or some ability to stand outside of her marginal identity.
Well, I think that goes also with the art. I mean, we don't require that there is a checklist to say this is Asian American art. When we define what is Asian American art, we use the definition that this is art created by persons of Asian ancestry, period. There is no aesthetic checklist. There is no stylistic checklist. There's no idiom or color work or media that we require to say this is an Asian American artist. Now, there are people out there who will dispute that and who argue that we talked a little bit during the break about Frank Chin, who argues that there is an Asian American literary aesthetic. And that if one doesn't meet that aesthetic, even if one is of Asian ancestry, that is not producing Asian American literature. And there are those who would argue the same thing with painting, that it has to exemplify certain stylistic dimensions to be qualified as an Asian American art. We don't follow that rule.
Julie, you're on with us. Good morning. Hi.
Hello. Hi. I'm a graduate student of art history at San Jose State University, and I have a question for Professor Gordon Chang. And it's in regards to hermeneutics. The problem that I'm having with Asian artists is that the Western discourse of mostly Lacan and Foucault is used in interpreting Asian art. Currently, I'm dealing with post-colonial art, but I believe it applies also for Asian American art. Is there a better or an appropriate framework for interpreting Asian art without being confined to a Western theoretical discourse?
Well, it's a good and complicated question that you pose, and I don't think I can give it justice at this point. Maybe we should get together and have a seminar about this sometime. But I think you're right in raising one of the challenges of understanding this art. That is, assuming that there's only Western theory from which to think about and interpret this art. There is many art theories, certainly, and historical traditions from which to draw in East Asia to look at this art as well. When we think about calligraphy, we think about aesthetics, philosophy, cosmology. These are philosophical and artistic and aesthetic traditions which are unfamiliar in the West, in Europe, and in the United States, and have not been included in many of the theories that you mentioned.
And thank you, Julie, for the call. When we talk about Asian American art, though, isn't it sort of axiomatic that some of the Southern Asian artists get short shrift here? I mean, there's an Afghan exhibit right now, in fact, at the Asian Art Museum we talked about here on Forum, but less attention paid, perhaps, to India, Pakistan, Afghanistan?
Yeah, so I wanted to mention two things. First, in response to your question, absolutely. But of course, because this follows a historical trajectory and the Chinese immigrated first, Japanese a little bit later in the 19th century, Filipinos and in greater numbers in the 1920s, and Koreans
sort of follows
a little
the
later.
Immigration
so it follows the immigration patterns. Yeah. And again, I was talking about, of course, we look forward to more research because the Asian American community in the United States is so much more incredibly diverse now than it was at that time. But also in response to the previous caller, I just wanted to mention in the Stanford University Press book, Asian American Art and History, the 10 scholars who contributed to it brought completely different frameworks for the contextualization of the work. So someone like Mei Ching Gao brought a Chinese perspective to the work. I wanted to mention Paul Karlstrom is the third co-editor with Gordon and I of the book, and he brought a modernist perspective to the book. And also Sharon Spain, the managing director, has brought all of these incredible biographical profiles so that we can see more about the people, not just talk about their work, but hopefully revivify these artists, who many of whom had been forgotten.
And again, if you'd like to join the program in the time remaining, it's toll-free 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. Let me go to some of the emails. This is Rochelle, who writes, "Thank you for this forum. I have seen the Asian art exhibit at the De Young and found it fascinating. This is an important part of American art and art history. We must now correct the dearth of exposure of these artists. I'm an African-American, and I support fulfilling the telling of the story and contribution of all Americans and artists. And as I read through the signage on much of the work, reference was made to the fact that many of these artists were colleagues of well-known European Impressionists. It was good to have these references to understand the influences and their association and training. However, it was unfortunate that these names were offering a certain, I hate to use the word, legitimacy to these artists. They should have, at minimum, the comparable recognition in our minds in history." Well, there again, you know, there wasn't anything about Foucault or Lacan, but there again is the Western connection to give it a kind of perhaps legitimacy. There's a pretty, well, shall we say, tender topic in itself. Richard writes, "As early as the mid-60s, growing up in a small rural town in the northern Rockies, my high school art teacher made me aware of the Bay Area's own Don Kingman, still one of my favorites. Unfortunately, I find that his work is hard to find now and would plan a trip back to the Bay Area if his work were featured in a show." Well, it's in this show, isn't it?
There's two examples of Don Kingman's work in the current show. One is a spectacular watercolor, which he was most famous for, America's number one watercolor. Actually, he was perhaps the most famous person of Asian ancestry in America at mid-century, not only artist. So one is a watercolor, but the other is a total surprise, I think, for just about everybody. It's a mural that measures perhaps 8 feet tall by 12 feet wide. And Don Kingman did many murals during his lifetime, but most of them were in buildings that have since been demolished and destroyed. So there's only a few that currently survive. So it's a unique opportunity to see that. I think one of the reasons Don Kingman's work is not more seen is because he chose to work in water media, and water media is more fragile, and so it's displayed less frequently in permanent collections of museums. It needs to be rotated. So sometimes just the choice of media impacts how people are historicized.
It's hard, and I don't think you can really separate this whole story we're talking about here about Asian American artists from the kind of stereotyping that was so indicative of American civilization, culture, whatever you want to call it at this time. Jessica Hagedorn, probably both of you are familiar with her work, you know, where she said Americans, this notion of Charlie Chan. You were talking about Don Kingman being the most famous American of Asian descent, but many Americans had in their mind these stereotypes, which were to some extent almost impregnable for years and overshadowed the possibility of many of these artists really getting the kind of respect and due.
I think it's true. We think in categories, and America was conceived of a certain race of people. American art was considered to be a certain type of art, Hudson River Valley, California Impressionism, which were done by people of European ancestry. It was hard to break out all those boxes. We've been getting to do that in recent years, as one of your emailers had talked about. But this was one of the challenges of the project, of how to break out of these conceptual boundaries of what is American art, what's East Asian art. And so many of these artists were not fully appreciated because they fell in between. They were not considered to be fully East Asian artists. They were not considered to be American artists either because of citizenship or because of style, because it was difficult to interpret This is why we needed to bring together this host of scholars to bring in their expertise to interpret the work.
Well, one of our listeners, Alan, says, thank you for bringing this overlooked aspect of Asian American cultural history to our attention. I hope this exhibit will help to dispel the stereotypes that have contributed to making this artwork largely unknown to the general public. And Leslie writes, can you talk about Martin Wong's involvement with the Angels of Light? I saw his calligraphic story at the De Young and really loved it, but was he also a realistic painter and performer?
Martin Wong, thanks for the question. Martin Wong was a visionary painter, principally, who was active as an artist from the time he was just a teenager. Grew up in San Francisco and, yes, was a early member of a performance group called the Angels of Light. Some of our listeners out there who remember those days may remember the Angels of Light, who gave free performances in Golden Gate Park. And Martin was their set designer. He wasn't really a performer, and he made fantastic visionary representational, but of the period sets. But he went on to be an acclaimed artist. After
in the realistic school, as they call it?
Yeah, realistic. I mean, I'm going to use the word illustrative because it certainly is pictures that are very recognizable. But realistic, there's the sky is full of American Sign Language hands spelling out things. And when people said, well, why do you have hands in the sky using American Sign Language to tell a story, he goes, well, because I'm a Chinese painter, there's always calligraphy in the sky in a Chinese painting.
Well, speaking of calligraphy, we've got a caller from El Dorado, Colorado. Barbara, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael and gentlemen. Not Colorado, El Dorado County, California.
Oh, I'm sorry. I saw CO. I thought it was Colorado.
Oh, well, I was a bit croaky. I just could not call you because I am of an age where I remember so much of, Herb Cain talking about Don Kingman, grew up in the city, but the thing that struck me as a child so very deeply was I happened to have to walk, not have to walk, but chose to walk down Grant Avenue after school into into where retail was then, and to meet my mother. And every day I would look in all of the shops, and the thing that struck me so strongly when I was a child, I was walking from Broadway down to Post Street. There was a shop on my right-hand side with an elderly gentleman who used to do calligraphy. And his shop was filled with calligraphy. He had all of the blocks and the special things. You could see it. Then when he would smile at me, and then I would go in the shop, and he would tell me about what things need. After that, my mother took an interest, and she used to get to know the people who had various shops, and it was just. Now, I was born in late 35. 45 was the war, and then 55. This went on to about 55. So I was welcomed into a very, very closed family community and got to see fabulous things. Didn't know what I was looking at, but responded. And it brings back a wonderful memory because I don't think kids get to see anything that's made today. Everything is packaged and pushed at them.
Well, that's a good point.
Terrible. And I have these, and you're talking about all these people that I'm missing. You know, by cracky, I'm going to get on the train and get my behind down to the museum.
Good for you, and thank you for the call. Lots of people are going to go see this exhibit, I think. Getting some real excitement generated here, including some of these emailers. Here's John who says, I was given a beautiful watercolor signed by Ling. I have been trying to find information on the artist, but have had little luck. The piece was, like so many of your stories, stored in a basement in the Sunset for years. Where can I take this work to find out about the artist?
Name was Ling?
Just Ling, L-I-N-G, yeah.
Don't know that name. There was somebody named Ing.
Yeah, and a wonderful watercolor painter named Wing. So yes, if it's a wing, we're real curious.
Well, or if it's, but where can people find out about authenticity or, you know, information?
Well, check the book first and find the biographies and check out some of the art that's in it. But we think quickly there are people are going to put together portfolios on.
Well, there are art dealers who are interested in this period, or I mean, of this genre of art.
There really is a lot of ignorance. Yeah. There are auction houses that occasionally sell pieces, and there are individuals who are specializing in one or two of the artists. But this is as I say when I begin talks about the book, is that I'm going to talk. About a subject that no one knows about.
Yeah, you both have a lot of educational work to do here and have done it. It's the public now who has to find out what the work is. Here's Brandon who writes, don't forget Yoko, okay?
And, of course, Yoko happily is in the exhibition, and she has two great pieces from the 1960s. One is called Painting Instructions to See the Sky, and the other Sky TV, where we're broadcasting an image of the sky onto a wall in the gallery. When we talked to her about doing the piece, she said, well, you know, when I first did it, we were exploring remote feed video direct to a TV. There was no video projectors at that time, she said, but I'm happy to see you use it in that way. And it captures the feeling of laying in the grass and just looking up at the sky.
Well, I hope that those of you listening who are interested will run and see this exhibit. It runs through January 18th at the De Young. The book, again, is a history, Asian American art, a history from 1850 to 1970 by Mark Dean Johnson and Gordon Chang. Thank you both for being here with us this morning.
Our great pleasure.
It was fun.
And thanks to Kimmy Hill, who joined us earlier by phone, and Irene Poon, who also joined us by phone. And thanks to you, our listeners and callers and emailers. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our interns are Sarah Bahat, Susan Breton, Tariq Fauda, Aliyah Madyun. And we also had production assistance from Kelly Pretzer. I also want to thank Megan Rollins. And our music is by Mike Marshall. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, thank you for being here. Thank you for being a part of our public radio enterprise. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.